I'm It was a 13-room, two-story home with four basements. 38 and 200 that year, we had a fire and lost that home at midnight. And it was grace of the people coming off of the midnight shift on the bridge, the waiting list who got us from out of the house at that time. I have nothing more to say except that I enjoyed the many years of the parade.
It's been a long time since I've been in this building. It's over 70 years ago that I had the benefit here for a teacher's institute and the teacher's institute that I own. And I used to sing in the choir up there, about 18. I was 1898. And I started teaching school in 1897. Oh, I could go on to all my history. My grandparents crossed the plains, was my mother selling purple study volcano and walkers around Ireland. And it was a time when I knew I could everybody in Ireland. I doubt if there's one human day that remembers me. So I could go on and on and on, but I'm not about to know.
Well, I don't believe that other than Mom, was born in Mount Echo 99 years ago, and this coming November, of course, they're celebrating his birthday. And they still have the ranch in Mount Echo.
I want you to know that Nina is my piano teacher. And I was 10 years old. And my grandfather took me to Sacramento and he took me to Sherman to play. And I was able to choose my own piano. And I'm 59 now, so you know how long ago that was. You know, take a 10-year-old child down and have the child choose his own piano. And because Nana said that she thought I had talent, I spoke that it's fine to acquire an instrument. So when I went that first day, she opened up a whole new beautiful world of classical music. I say classical music because as soon as I learned how to read music, I went to Sherman and Play again and bought the Isle of Capri. I'm sure she would like to know that after all these years. Exactly what a child would do. If she learned how to do something, it would go someplace else. But she did teach me all the beautiful things about classical music and life itself. And every Monday, sometimes for years, we become the friendly philosophers and we solve the problems of the world on Monday. Only on Monday. That's the day when we're allowed to climb up on our soapboxes and we just really give everybody a holy head. And I want you to know that my daughter Arlene just thinks that Nana is just really remarkable. So she, whenever something happens to the economy or government or something over, she calls home and she wants to know I'm 90 fingers. And she, not too long ago, there was something about the towers down here in the paper in Fresno, and she called home and she said, I want to know. I'm 90 fingers. She said, I know. I tell my friends, I'll get key and my mother out there with placards marching. So we've enjoyed, I'm sure, a relationship that most people don't have. Our closeness that we really need to do. I appreciate everything that you've done for us. Thank you. Her family and all the friends in our neighborhood, but we just have a really nice time out there in
Jason Church, Kathleen McCauley, and that was a cousin of Marie's sisters and was also my sister. And the tombstone only had one date on it, so the deduction was that she must still be living. We went down to the corner drugstore and asked if anybody knew Kathleen McCauley, and they said, everybody knows Kathleen McCauley, and just come right out here, I'll show you where she lives. So three blocks down the street is where Kathleen McCauley lived. And it was a case of where we were in Frankfort, Ontario. I said, Rebecca, it was Ontario. I said, on the 80th birthday of Marie's sister Eileen, and she had never been back in the intervening years, and this Kathleen McCauley did take her out and took her to the house where she was, what folks had told where Eileen was born. Eileen and this Kathleen McCauley corresponded for a number of years, and when she got to the age of the other Kathleen McCauley announced that she was going to be married, Marie's sister decided she didn't know how to write to a married lady, so she quit corresponding. When we arrived there and went up to the door, Marie's sister went to the door and knocked and said, are you Kathleen McCauley? She said, yes. She said, do you remember an Eileen Hines that used to correspond with you? And she said, I do. And she says, well, I'm not Eileen Hines. And she said, you go. So that's an interesting story as far as the historical society of the presentation. Years have gone by, about half of them are 30 years.
Most of us know about Nina and her good works. great philosophy. That's what we have in common. Mine is a great philosophy.
Without professional advice. And to find a professional, you have to go to a bartender or to any head waiter at a restaurant that you admire, and you ask them to give you the name of the designer of the restaurant. That is how the Cavaliers found John Maurer.
We talked to John. He came down to Atlantic City. He met with us down here. We showed him our site and said, John, you know, can we do this down here?
My first reaction was,
we have our recorder set up now.
We have a Werner.
Here it is.
Yes, right.
One hardly knows where to begin.
Where to end.
To try to talk about someone who has lived for 90 years in this rumble-tumble world we live in. I've known Nina for 27 years now, that the period of time I have lived in Amador County. And she was among the first that I knew when I came here, and there's been a very warm relationship between my wife and Nina. While I haven't heard it directly from Nina, I've heard it from my wife, what Nina had to say and what she was getting into, and some of the dreams that she's had. This business of living is a very serious thing, and I guess we only get it through experience. However, I was trying to think of some sort of an outline. Being a preacher, you get 1, 2, 3 points, you see. And if everybody is awake while you pronounce a benediction, let them go home after that. But I was trying to think of some part of the business of living that fit Nina. And I was thinking of the one who knew more about living than any other person that's ever trod the face of the earth. That is a carpenter from down Nazareth way. One time trying to teach a group of people how to live, he was on the side of a mountain and he gave them a talk about the business of living. And in that is an outline, I believe, that the only outline that's ever going to make a decent world of the world we live in. And I think that Nina pretty well has shown us that that works. He began it by saying, "Blessed are the poor in spirit." Now, I've studied this statement in the original Greek in which it was written, and then in the Aramaic, and it does no harm to say to one that what he was actually saying to people is, "Blessed are the people with an open mind." You know, Nina has had that. I have known a good deal about her people in the early beginnings. She came into this area when she was a young bride. And across the years, she has faced the reality of the days in which we were living. And of course, there has been the changes that's come, but Nina has always had a mind that's open. And I know that because of some of the reading material that I have seen. That's a thing that has kept her young and kept her alert. She's kept step with the days in which we move. She was talking about the old lampshade and all that sort of thing. But I know she moved right along with electric light. And I said, "Where's that antenna for that TV around here someplace? There's got to be one here someplace." And she has her programs. I hope she watches All in the Family, because I think it's the best thing on the air myself. And things of that sort. You get a lot of good out of that, and it keeps you young, and that's what keeps her laughing and smiling. But life is more than a bunch of roses. The next thing that he said to him, "Blessed are they that mourn, for they shall be comforted." You know, you never mourn about anything unless you're concerned about it. I know no person that ever graced the Amador Valley that has been more concerned about her world than Nina Winters. She's concerned about the trend of things. I wouldn't call her one that belonged to a suffragette group or the women's, what they call this women's group that is going around, you know. She's concerned about people's groups. And across the years, she has tried to stand for that in the community. Wherever there is a social issue, you'll find Nina. If she can get there, she's there doing something about it. These are the things that makes for living, is to keep in step with the times that you are living in. I'm sure she loves the country as I love my country. Our country, we love it, but we do not believe it's perfect. And there's a lot of things in this world right now that's quite disturbing. I get a chance to talk to quite a number of people. We do a good deal of traveling, and I talk to these people wherever I go. Things aren't like they ought to be. There's a whole lot of people that are living below par today that ought not to be living below par. There's just an awful lot of our money that's being wasted and being spent in fields that we're not very happy about these days. We're not going to live in a world that's going to be ruled by force or by threats or things of that sort. And all the money you want to pour into a military program is not going to bring the kind of a world that we want to live in. If you know anything at all about history, history is on our side when I make such a statement as that. Arnold Toynbee, in his History of Civilization, points that out very definitely, that those nations that have tried to threaten the other nations of the world or tried to run over other nations of the world have signed their only death warrant. China has been very definite in that field, opposing that sort of a philosophy, as I'm sure the great Carpenter was 2,000 years ago. These are the things that are disturbing to us. And I'm sure these are the things that has caused Nina more than one night, sleepless night, wondering just what we can do and how we can operate in a world like this. But slowly but definitely we're making some progress. Slowly and definitely things are changing. But they'll only change as we have people like this good woman that has pushed for a good share of her 90 years, has pushed for these things. They come when we make them come. And that should be a challenge to each one of us. For each one of us, we count. Each one of us has something to say. And as we stand up and be counted in this, ultimately things begin to change. And I'm sure that that's one of the things that has kept this good woman going. She's not willing to drop the torch and let somebody else pick it up. You know, a lot of people say, well, one person doesn't count, but Jesus said a long time ago, blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Blessed are the meek, not the weak, the meek. The people that go along steady, day in and day out, the people you can depend upon, the people that day after day have a goal in mind, and they find every way possible to work toward that end. These are the people that have made the great progress. People with a spirit like Abraham Lincoln did more than all the military programs put together toward making this nation what it is today. And this thing will go on that way. In the history of civilization, gradually things keep building up and building up and building up. It's true in the animal kingdom. I was up at the Stampede at Calgary this last week or so, and saw those marvelous horses, and then I saw there the pictures of what they started with years ago, and slowly they took them out of the wilderness, out of the wildness, and brought them up and up and up, and see, you have these beautiful animals today. I spent this afternoon on the floor at home playing with my poodles. I got three poodles. I love them, every one of them. There was a time when they belonged to the wolf family, way back there, and they lived with a tooth and a fang. But today, I have to cook for them every night. Now I take care of them, see. They don't go out and take care of themselves anymore. They gave up something, and out of their giving up something, they are what they are today, see. That's the kind of a world we've got to have, and it's the only kind of world we can live in. And this good woman will bear testimony out of 90 years of experience that that is a truth. And that is the thing that should challenge us and send us on. Nina, we salute you tonight. Salute you for the thing, for the militancy of your life, for the determination, the bulldog determination that you have, see, that has kept you at it when a lot of people thought maybe you're queer at times, see. No doubt, that's no doubt, see. But who didn't they think was queer? Queerest people that walked across the face of the earth is the people that made the greatest contribution, see. So you're in darn good company when they call you a queer individual in these days, see? So we salute you, and Bertha, we're glad you're here to kind of keep her in line because you're 2 years older than she is tonight. Thank you for the moment that I had to say something to you.
Arrangements were made. This is just these things that are falling into place. I thank you for your kind patience. And do we have anyone that would like to add a few more words? Maybe we would all like to see the family stand up so that we know who the Werner family are. The Winter family. May we have you all stand up, family?
Someone in the house.
Well, someone, will someone go in and call?
Here's one over here. There's one. There's young George. And the Dutch Keith, too.
Dutch Keith, I understand you're part of the family.
Oh, we're way down
the line. They're part of the family.
We'll, as soon as they come out.
They're coming. Here's Dorothy.
Real good. Dorothy, Meyer, and Susan. We all. Nice to meet you. Nice to meet you all. And Nina, is there anything else you'd like to say?
Oh, my goodness. It's almost too much for me. I've done my jingle.
Wonderful. Ramona would like to have a word or two,
yes,
Ramona.
I want to say that Nina taught me to play the piano.
Beautiful.
And I'm 10 years old, I came home.
Well,
it'll be all right.
And Ramona. And Ramona plays a little thing called Kiss Rainy.
One other thing we might do,
being
equal rights thing,
I
think she deserves one more song. For she's a jolly good fellow.
For she's a jolly good fellow. For she's a jolly good fellow. For she's a jolly good fellow. Which nobody can deny, which nobody can deny, which nobody can deny. For she's a jolly good fellow, for she's a jolly good fellow, for she's a jolly good fellow, which nobody can deny.
Before you people put your cups away, we have more coffee here.
Nina, it's not cast any reflections on her because we all know what she is and who she is. But it's my get up and go. How do I know that my youth is all spent? Well, my get up and go has got up and went. But in spite of it all, I'm able to grin when I think of the places that my get up has been. With my ears in the drawer and my teeth in the cup, with my eyes on the table until I wake up, ears deep into my eyes, I say to myself, is there anything else I should lay on the shelf? Today I am happy as I close the front door. My friends are the same, only now there are more. Now, when I was young and my slippers were red, I could pick up my heels right over my head. And as I grew older, my slippers were blue. But still, I could dance the whole night through. Now I am old and my slippers are black. I walk to the store and I puff my way back. The reason I know my youth is all spent, my get up and go has got up and went. But I really don't mind when I think with a grin of all the grand places my get up has been. I get up each morning and dust off my wits. I pick up the paper and I read the obit. If my name isn't listed, I know I'm not dead. So I eat a good breakfast and go back to bed.
Is there anyone else that would like to add anything to the program? Well, we thank you, and we do hope you visit and share one another.
Oh, Nina, I would like to sing a song to you.
All right.
Now I'm going to sing something. It's old, and I think everyone here, and if you'd like to join in, everyone join in.
That's fine.
All right? Let me call you, sweetheart. I'm in love with you. Let me hear you say that I love you too.
Barney's just going to go on and on, Nina.
I think you're the only one who can live up to it. I really do.
Think of the day when I was born. The air was full, was free. Better start again. I can't see. Think of the day when I was born. The air was free of sound of horns. Autos, planes, and things like that had not appeared on Earth as yet. Wood and coal we used for heat. No ringing phones did silence break. Lamps gave us what we had for light to guide us in the dark of night. No woman dared to cast a boat. She could do naught of any note. She must keep busy in the house to make things tidy for her spouse. And often when she thought of freedom, she then in truth was not forgiven. This was the era whence I came. You must not then think I'm to blame for being just a little queer and loving all old things as dear. One should not dwell on years gone by, for we all know that time does fly. The 90 years that have just gone, as the age of science it is known, it has been filled with great inventions to aid us in our many ventures. Electric is the word we worship. We're sure we cannot live without it. Gadgets are found everywhere. They even brush our teeth with care. The air and streams are so polluted, we dare not breathe or drink the water. Come then and celebrate with joy, not tears, the passing of these 90 years. So I could do better, but, you know, I've had a lot of education. Not put out anything like that. It's just jingles. No, I just tried to do a jingle.
It does mention the Winter Brothers, but it is really their picture's not there and their home's not there and all that, because they didn't pay, you know, to, well, they weren't too interested, I guess. They were foreigners, you might say.
Well, if you know that, then the history book can be of some value, but I first noticed this. No one told me this. I looked at it. I didn't know from anything. And I happened to be in the California Book Company, which in San Francisco, which specializes in history books and stuff. And here were 10 books written by Masons. You know, Calaveras County, El Dorado County,
yeah.
And then it clicked.
Yeah.
You know, I said this guy had to have drummers going around and collecting money from people, and I'm sure if you paid them $50, you got your picture.
Yeah, that was right.
But
that
then
was
in
right.
Turn, he's not going to write anything derogatory about you. But my idea is that the most important thing to me are the people. Not the dates, necessarily. I mean, they're important, but the facts and figures you can dig up anywhere. But ideally is to write something in such a way that you get a feel for the times.
Yeah, maybe you're more like Mrs. Bangier. She likes to go.
Oh, you know, she's. I've only met her once.
Oh, yeah.
And I should go over and touch because she's real nice.
She is just very fine.
Well, then I noticed when we went to the fair that her son, and he won. My wife said, "Who took these photographs?"
Yeah.
And I looked and I saw his name, and boy, is he talented.
Oh, yeah. He did some pictures of her for me,
Family.
Old pictures that my niece wanted in Washington, D.C.
But if you look at her from the viewpoint of like a personal history of Amador County as seen through the eyes of its residents or its citizens. That, to me, is the, sort of important thing. And your family, of course, being, one of the oldest here.
Well,
it's really interesting. All the little anecdotes and stories, everything's important.
Mr. Sonato said, that wasn't too early. They came in 67. But Miss Dutchke, you were over at Dutchke, old Aunt Mary Dutchke, she was the old Mrs. Dutchke, the old woman.
Everything's relative. You have to have the...
Well, I wouldn't quibble over 15 years when you're talking about 1860 or 1867.
And she was here, I think, maybe just four years. I think they can't... Started to live over there in 1864, so about 3 years. And that was why...
Of course, she wasn't old then. She wasn't...
No, she was still having children. Anyway, the old folks... there was one boy settled in Yolo, and the old folks... the property was so high over there, and so they thought it was. And so they came over here. And here was this house for sale. And it was this house.
This house?
Yeah, most of it. this room over here is part of it. And it's been sort of worked over, as you see. It had to be, or we couldn't live in it. And so they bought it. Some of the high school youngsters were out here to get me to tell them about the history. And I mentioned the fact that the old folks came over from Europe to get out of the military service. One of the children said, "Are you sure you want to put that in?" you go and ask people around, nearly everybody did the same thing.
Oh, of course. What's the name spelled?
W-I-N-T-E-R.
Yeah. Oh, really?
Yeah. I understand it's very, very common in, particularly in German. And I think the Irish spell it with an S, winters.
Yeah.
And they want to put it on ours, but it isn't there. It's winter.
Everybody is inclined, because you don't say, "I'm going to the winter. I'm going to the winters," and people will automatically say,
Yes.
Do you have some stuff there that you...
I wrote this, and I started a history of Ion Valley, and I got as far as and there's some errors, it has to be corrected.
Maybe I can read it to you, and then we can get it on the tape.
Oh, you...
Sure. Ion Valley is located in Amador County, California, in the foothills of the Sierra Nevada Mountains.
Yes.
It consists of several hundred acres of very productive land. Three creeks flow into the valley: Sutter Creek, Mule Creek, and Dry Creek. The valley is surrounded by hills which contain certain minerals, clay and lignite. In the early days, it was much admired for the large oak and cottonwood trees which grew along the banks of the streams. There was also an abundance of wild grapes and tall native grasses. It seemed to our ancestors to be an ideal place in which to establish a home. In order to understand some of the problems of the early settlers, a few historical facts should be considered. 200 years ago, when our forefathers were fighting for our independence, California and Mexico belonged to Spain. In 1822, Mexico won her independence from Spain, and for about a quarter of a century, California was governed by Mexico. In 1840, Juan Alvarado governor of California, granted to Teodosio Yerba?
Right? Either way, Yerba or Yerba.
Oh, I see you have Teodosio Yerba, 11 leagues of land. The boundaries of this great grant, known as Arroyo Seco, were very indefinite. It extended from the Consumnes River on the north to the Mokelumne River on the south, and from a Sacramento road on the west to the Sierra Nevada Mountains on the east. All of Ione Valley was included in this grant. By 1846, the United States seemed to be of a mind to expand. President Polk declared war on Mexico, in which the United States was victorious. By the Treaty of Hidalgo Guadalupe, May 1848, we gained California, as well as other territory. And by 1850, California became a part of the Union. In 1852, Yerba sold the Arroyo Seco grant to Andres Pico for 500 head of cattle.
Yes.
The deed was recorded in Los Angeles County and later in Amador County. The United States government chose to consider that Andres Pico was the legitimate owner of the land in this grant. Some parcels of land were sold, but some of them fell into the hands of unscrupulous land speculators. There was much litigation, and some of the early settlers were obliged to pay twice for their land. There were many Indians living in the valley, but any right they had to the land seems to have been completely disregarded. The history of the Arroyo Seco grant is a sordid tale and a long and complicated one. Blank Downey, governor of California in 1860, called this grant a rank fraud. The grant most certainly did affect the conditions of the newcomers to the valley. The owners of the Arroyo Seco grant always were absentee landlords, and they had little interest in the well-being of the county. In 1876, the smaller landowners complained that they paid more than their share of taxes, while the large landowners paid only a nominal sum. There are at present 1,975 acres of land in the Arroyo Seco grant.
I don't know why that's a date.
Yeah.
How many? 33,000, I think it's.
There are at present approximately 33,000 acres of land in the Arroyo Seco grant in Amador County. In Amador County and other counties.
Yes.
The landlords to this day have never lived on the grant, but tax assessments are still slanted in their favor. In 1848, gold was discovered in California, and this led to a great influx of population. People came from Europe, South America, the eastern part of the United States, and even China. For the most part, those who settled in Ione Valley were farmers, not miners. One of the first ranches to be settled was the Hicks Ranch, now owned by Guard Chisholm of Sutter Creek. It seems to have been established in 1847, and the owner was obliged to pay twice for the property because of the Arroyo Seco grant. A house was finally built there, part of which was said to have come around the horn. It later burned. The Clarence Fairbank family lived there for a number of years. Another early one was the Kew Ranch, which received its name from Henry Gibbons, who was a member of Company Q of the Ohio Volunteers, date of sale 1850. It was bought in 1853 by Charles Green. It became well known. It had a post office, a blacksmith shop, and a racetrack.
That was right up here at the corner.
Where was the Q Ranch?
Right there at the corner.
Right at the corner of your driveway?
It's on both sides of the road as you come in. Our land doesn't go out that far, but it's on both sides of the road.
When did it stop? Was it operated as a regular commercial ranch, money-making venture?
Sort of a stopping place.
Oh, like a way stop?
Well, they kind of a type of hotel.
What buildings were
there? There were all kinds of buildings.
Now the racetrack.
The racetrack was
right
across the road.
Mm-hmm. All across from the end of the lane.
The racetrack?
Well, what race? Autos?
Horses. Oh, I should have said horses.
A regular horse track with bedding and everything.
Quite a track. I think I've been told it was right across the road. Mm-hmm. But you see, in my day, that across the road was not considered the Q Ranch. The Q Ranch was only on this side of the highway. But when these people, you know, our friend Serotoma?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, you do. Well, when he takes over that gravel operation up there, he calls it the Q Ranch, and it was originally, but it hadn't been for years and years and years.
Do you have any idea when the Q Ranch ceased to exist? Was that way back when?
Oh, it still exists. It's still a Q Ranch.
I mean, when did it stop operating?
In the depression, it went on up into the late 20s then. Had one of the finest orchards in the state of California. Had won prizes with our fruit. And when I came here, there was a packing shed on that, great big packing shed on that side of the high road. And another shed over here where they, well, they sulfured the dried fruit to keep the bugs out. This is something that I wanted to tell you before you can tell it from that. Nothing changes more constantly than the past. Have you read that? For the past that influences our lives does not consist of what actually happened, but of what man believed happened. Is that right?
Uh-huh.
Now you see, I admit I am very, very prejudiced. I'm full of prejudice. This Grant thing over here has been one of our problems all our lives.
Yeah.
It still is, you see.
Well, your family came here and they couldn't speak English, right?
That's right. German only, but they spoke high German.
Yeah.
They were from near Stuttgart.
Why did they come here?
Well, their daughter lived down here. That was the one reason that they came here. They came here to, and this place was for sale.
Oh, and their daughter, what was her name?
Mary Dutschke.
Mary Dutschke.
Yeah.
I see. Okay, the relationship there.
Yeah.
And,
to get the idea of the family.
Well, maybe you could give me an idea of the Grant, from a personal standpoint, of the Grant and the problems that they must have faced back in those days.
Well, the problems they faced. In the early settlers, in the first place, the early settlers, like down here on the Chisholm Place. This is just below us, the one that's
here.
Garden. And I understand his father, his grandfather, I guess, tied it up so they can't sell it. So it's there. And they had to buy that again. You see, they thought that the United States owned it and people bought the land. And then when they finally decided, and that was, and that name Downey, there was a grandson that is named Downey. He's been here at my house. And he was also a prominent politician. And his name was Sheridan. But what the other man's name was, I haven't been able to run down yet. But I can find it, I'm sure. Somewhere. Okay. He was governor of California.
Yeah, well, I'll look that up and I'll put that in.
Yes, because I didn't want to confuse it. I don't have things.
Well, basically, the problems they faced were when they wanted to do anything with the land, were just being stomped on by state.
Well, they were all around us, you see.
Yeah.
And in 62, and that was before the family came, they had already, you see, the gold rush was in 48, and all had about those few years in there to operate. So they had various mining operations up above, and they had a big flood, a cloudburst of some kind, and all their debris washed down onto the land, the good land, and that was hard. And Dry Creek up here was flowing over here, where you see that row of trees that are still left, that's where the creek went. And it changed its course over here. So Dry Creek runs over here now instead of over there now. Some of those things they had to put up with. And when the early settlers would get their land pretty well established and get something cleared off, maybe a little dwelling, but then they'd come along and say, well, this belongs to the Grant.
Who were the people? I mean, who was running the Grant? This is what.
Well, there are names in that book you saw when you were.
You mean, in other words,
it was a bunch of speculators from
San Francisco with the state or whatever it is who would come along and say, "No, you don't have a right to."
You see, the Methodist Church in Ione had a parsonage. And the Grant came along and said, that doesn't belong to you. It belongs to the Grant. So you will have to pay us rent. So they paid, I think it was $7 a month. It was nominal, not much. And then they raised it to $10 a month. And the church said, oh, we can't do that. So they went to work and built the parsonage. Right back of the church, it's there today. They've been restoring it.
I imagine.
And so they wouldn't have to rent the parsonage from the Grant. I've been trying to find out where that was, but I don't know.
It's like trying to find windmills.
Yes, I mean, it was. It was hard.
Someone comes to you and says, you know, the Grant says, well, who are you? And yes. All kinds of things. You don't know who to find. Boy. Where were you born?
In Illinois. Out of St. Louis. Not far from St. Louis. Yeah, that's bad, isn't it?
No.
That down in the Egypt, they call it. Mr. Warner, our minister up here, always says that's where they don't wear shoes. Mrs. Warner and I were both born there.
When did you move here?
When I was married.
No. Oh,
it came in 1911. I came. But of course my husband was born here.
Yeah.
God.
1911.
How did Paul meet you?
At school.
Yeah. When he went to that school?
Well, they were very religious. High school children were out here talking to me. One of their questions, and they must have had a list, you know. What did they do for recreation? I said, oh, they had their religion. And it was true. That was about all they had. Just about all they had. Tell Myron to come in if he wants to come in. He knows more of this than I do. He's been
here. The idea was that the family was Free Methodist.
They were Free Methodist.
And their little school in Purple Town was Free Methodist.
It was a college.
And, yes, a college.
Liberal arts.
And you see, they
still accredited.
So deeply on Greenville College, and they were so deeply religious in that sense that they would send, in those days, they sent him back.
They sent the daughter to one in Seattle, and so they sent him back there, and that was where
now
I met.
Now, what years, because you graduated in 1911.
And then I was married the next year,
something like that.
He graduated a year before I was.
Uh-huh. And he graduated from there, but he went to Stanford.
Well, he went to Stanford for a short time, but he was graduated from high school. But he was, there were no schools, no high schools. And he was one of, I think, the first class that was graduated, he belonged to. And he was older.
And then after graduation, you both came back here.
And then, no, he came after me then. He came back here and went to work on the ranch. The ranch was considered, somebody said, that, were you crazy to go on a ranch? Yes, I was. But it was considered at that time. See, that was 1910.
Why would that be any crazier than anything than working in the mines or anything else?
Yeah. Well, as it turned out during his freshman years, it was just John Fraser. But then Mighty and everything else was, too.
Well, I wondered about that, and I get different stories. People have told me that, oh boy, that's the reason Jackson was like it was, because there was no depression, and the mind still went and this and that. I don't know, but that's not necessarily the case, then.
Not with us. Not with the
part. No, I mean,
well,
the mind.
Keep going during the day, operate during the depression?
Well, you remember Roosevelt, they decreased the practical
gold, yeah.
And made it illegal to. Yeah, so I think that's when the mine went out. But
well, it probably stopped a lot of high grading. Right,
yeah.
But you see, back in the Middle West, farming was considered. If you owned some property,
oh, yeah,
some farm property.
I had an uncle that
raised corn in Illinois and Iowa. And
I had an uncle that had a large acreage around Decatur, Illinois. That's up in the good country,
mm-hmm,
where they raise corn and all that stuff.
Well, what crops did you? You worked on the ranch. Well, what were your crops and what did you grow?
How many chickens were here when you came?
Oh,
he didn't know about a chicken from another, are they? And how many was here when you came?
600.
Oh.
We had
a little girl. I don't know what is going on.
Every
today,
year
anyway,
we raised 600 chickens. I never want to see another chicken.
Here she was raised.
Have you read the egg and
yeah.
She was raised with Greek and Latin and music, very culturally. For those days, you know, for an average
family.
My father
was an attorney.
Yeah. And here she comes out with 600
chickens.
Out
of the Wild West.
Yeah.
And it was wild.
You know, you tend to think, now, like Amador County, parts of it didn't get electricity until even in the 30s and stuff like that.
Oh, no, we didn't.
You know, you didn't have it, obviously, well, way back then, but back in the Midwest, I mean, there really must have been a great deal more difference between here and there then, and now it's almost all the same.
Yes, it's very similar, I think.
But, you know, it'd be like someone who'd been born and raised in New York coming out to the West, so it's not, you know, what do you do? But you know,
having and then the family, you see, that had been here, that had run all this. How many were there? Now there were.
Well, they had all kinds of people to operate it. So just couldn't get the work done. We finally sold the chickens to circus as well. Well, we had a dairy.
Well, it was dairy.
So you had cows too.
Oh, yes, and a hog.
Oh, no, they must have been real choice things to have.
Were they still here when you took it over? Were they?
They moved right away. They bought a house in Sacramento.
And so it was only the two of you running it?
Yeah, that was it.
They moved out.
Well, then, and your husband, he didn't really have that much experience probably running a ranch.
Well, he's been here all his life.
Yeah, but I mean, still actually running.
Showing these pictures just for fun.
Well, you kind of have to see all four of them there. This is Paul.
That's my
husband.
Boy, he looks big enough to do, you know.
Yeah, he was
big man.
And this is Myron. This is Myron's son, Lynn.
Oh,
and this is Lynn's son.
Oh, wow.
Oh, this too. This is Lynn and Joe and Stephen.
We've got the whole family up there.
That's a good thing. I like that picture.
Don't you?
Yeah, that's a good picture.
Uh-huh. And they were all big like that.
If you had any big and strapping, I guess, or you were doomed. I don't think people today can, like where we live, we have to do a lot of things on our own, but it's nothing like this was. The things today that you take for granted, period, turning on your electric lights, doing that, you had to work so much for. I mean, it was, say, 3 or 4 hours a day, cutting your wood, doing this, pumping your water.
We had a plant out here in the exile the folks had built with gas. For gas, and it made gas, and they had gas lights in the house, which was not very many did have. So they were ahead of.
They put a little building.
Yeah, they had a little building.
I can't imagine how you make gas.
Oh, yes. What company was that? Myron knows. Tell him to come in here.
Okay.
He knows what the name of it was.
He has a memory of his father.
When you get to be as old as I am, you're loose.
Well, you kept up your interest in music right out, right through everything. How long did it take you to get a piano? Or was one here?
We bought one shortly after we were married. And then I bought another one when I was in Berkeley. Then I finished up buying this one. And the one down in Berkeley, I don't know, it's still down there and they don't know how to get it out of down the hill. But what I played on at the little school was a grand canabe. And, you know, they had trouble with it, the father and the son or the relatives, do you remember?
Yeah.
But this was the old, old canabe, the good one.
They're great, yeah.
And it was good. I don't care what you say, it was good. It was very good. Big grand. And they were very religious when I went there, and they didn't want to have this, and they didn't want to have that. I went back, I guess, and when I'd been graduated, I think 40 years. And here was.
Okay, a lot of so this is nice compared to outside.
You can turn on the cooler anytime. Here was velvet curtains up and a band all in uniform. They'd forgotten their religion.
Oh, wow.
And the best of magazines in their little libraries, you know.
Uh-huh.
But we were required to do a lot of reading, like Origin of Species and things.
Oh.
The old Free Methodist sisters from the Good Part, they know about it.
Nina was mentioning that you had a gas generating plant here.
Yes.
So
what was
it? Well,
we want to tell you,
Megan. Well, I mean, I don't even not heard of those things.
You're buying calcium carbide, which is which when you mix it with water, gives off the sodium gas.
Right.
Welders use that system a lot.
Yeah.
Instead of buying bottles of sodium, we use it. Calcium carbide and strip water and selling gas out. Yeah, we had one of those.
We had a regular, just like a giant miner's helmet kind of thing.
Yeah. I don't know, the part of the tank's still down here, but it floated in water. You know, and as the gas was used, the float went down, and then as it went down to a certain level, I dumped a little more water into the carbide. Generated a little more gas.
Did it ever blow up?
No, I don't think so.
No, we didn't have any trouble. They go around with little matches. You remember those little matches?
Well, there's still some of the piping that just go up. I didn't take it all down. Yeah, they had gas lights, I guess.
Yeah,
that's
right.
Of course, I don't know what year that was installed.
I don't know either.
The Delco generator, 32 volt system that ran on kerosene. It was installed about 1920, or a little before, I think.
Yeah,
I think. A little before 1920, maybe around 1920.
Considering the price of electricity today, we should go back to some of those systems.
Well, I don't know if they want to go back to that.
No,
probably not.
That Delco system, not. It had some pretty bad hazards.
Oh, well, I tell you, so you had cattle and you had chickens. And did you have to milk cows?
No, I didn't. I never
about that. Well, it couldn't have been many people up here that would. How did you find customers?
Oh, gracious.
Everybody wanted to learn how to play the piano?
Well, I had plenty of customers. Ramona was one of my pupils.
Was Ramona one of your pupils?
Yeah.
Can she still play?
Oh, my word. She keeps everything going.
Really?
All the churches?
Catholics? Plays for the churches?
Or anything else?
The Catholics or Mormons? Or she plays all around.
Was it, Mm-hmm. So you teach them basically classics, and did you get into popular music at all?
No, mostly just plain classical.
What was the one I the Gollywog's Cakewalk? That must have been one.
How classical can you get, huh?
Oh, my.
I have albums, yeah, Beethoven, Mozart, Chopin, Liszt, all that. That was what I had to study. And Clementi, you remember that? Clementi, Gradius, Optimasum, Steps to Perfection, whatever it meant. Tosi, that was the technique. All that.
Well, you were playing the piano until you hurt your wrist, right?
Yeah, I can't handle it any, and my eyes are so bad that keyboard even blurs. It's hard, awful hard, so I just don't try.
If my brother comes, he's coming next year, Joey, he'll be here in about a month. I'll call you, he'll be here for a few days, I'll send him in and he can tune the piano. It's only taking 20 minutes to do it.
Well,
yeah, he always carries his tuning hammer around with him.
It's all right, but you see, each key has three strings.
Right.
I think
are any of them broken?
I don't know. I don't think so. I don't think so. It's odd to
have to clean it before it gets you.
Well, that's what I'm worried about.
That's when you should see the piano. That's what he does for a living. He has to tune his piano almost every day. He hits it so hard. He's got an iron fist.
And that was one thing that we were trained not to do. Let's see, my teacher would say, the tone that you get back is what you put in it, yourself. And so that was a poor thing. The older teachers, when I came along, had that long, stiff wrist. They'd play with pennies on the back of their hand, and they would hit and hit. And then along came this method. It was Rubenstein. I'm not so sure who it was. Paderewski was the exponent of it. And we were taught not to pound. I don't know how to express it.
I know what you mean.
Yeah. That was what she idea. And if you wanted your tones to sing, you had to put that in.
No, that's great. You know, getting back to the ranch, you have chickens and eggs and hogs and everything. I don't really have any idea how people managed to get by without, you know, how you did anything when you didn't have refrigeration. The concept is almost beyond me.
We
have
a high refrigerator.
Yeah, but I mean, you've got all these eggs, you've got chickens. How do you keep things fresh? What is it?
Get rid of them
fast.
We
have
a crate in no time of eggs, and we shipped to a concern called Levi Zentner.
Levi Zentner, in San Francisco.
They're still there,
yeah. They're down on 3rd Street.
Yeah, it operates up in the North Coast, around Eureka or something like that. It's still operating. I don't know what they handle now, but they handle all sorts of stuff like that.
Yeah, I know. I've seen their signs. They've got a bunch of big warehouses. How would they transport it? By the days before the
train.
Cars.
Yes, the train came through in 1876. That was
before
I came.
It was shipped by rail.
You went down and...
You have them all
down
there?
You took them to Iowa. Mm-hmm. Oh. And they loaded them onto the freight car.
That's right.
But depending on the time of year, how hot it was, maybe every day, in weather like this, when it cooled off, it would have been maybe every other day. And possibly in winter time, maybe around 40 or 50 degrees.
heart. So, keeping me, think about that was concerning. We had all sorts of preserving.
Smoking it.
Yeah, and all
smoking it.
Yeah, a little smoke outside here. I don't know, it's gone now. It was a mess. But I think the views, I think I can have a big view. But besides that, again, these barrels, it's all purling.
Sausage.
They had rocks. They put them in and they weighed them on the rocks. Some of the rocks were still around. They had nice smooth rocks. Streams so they can wash through.
Yeah.
They get away. And dial those on top of the salt water.
Was the racetrack going when you were little?
It was not a horseshoe. There was a racetrack, what is now Howard Park.
Yeah.
Even that, I don't know what it was when I was really young, but the time I got messed with it, I was overgrown with the brush and so on. It had to be used again for quite a while. But the Q Ranch was already split up. Part of it was the other side of 104, part of this side. And it was already split ownership. I think four different parcels, at least four.
Yeah.
Maybe five.
Well, let's see. Oh, well, you came here letting so Preston was already there.
Yes.
But do you remember when they built that thing? Was there, did the people want it? Did they figure it would bring business and, you know, and a lot of people into town? Or were they fighting like cats and dogs to keep it out? I wonder.
I think they wanted it. I think they thought that they were doing this place a big favor. And it was an entirely different institution.
Yeah.
Entirely.
Well, it was almost like a military school kind
yeah.
of thing, wasn't it? Well, why did anybody decide to? I'm really curious as to why they built the castle to look like it, which isn't necessarily very practical. It's a fascinating thing to look at. You'd never guess in a million years, but you know, if you didn't know what it was for. I guess they just wanted to build a big imposing building.
I have no idea how that was.
It was not, it came about to be something like that, but originally the concept was to have a fairly young wards.
Yeah.
For prisoners, or whatever you want to call them. And, it's changed a lot over the years. Boston Lines, you know, it's gone up and down in each grouping. I think they selected this place because there was almost nothing between Iona, what's now Highway 99 and 12.
Yeah.
And the other way, you had to go to these clinics. 18 miles or something like that. And they figured they'd never go toward Jackson because it'd be further away from Los Angeles. San Francisco, where most of them came from. They were mostly into the city problems, I think, that were sent up here. Been here between the things.
And they weren't nearly as bad to handle.
Oh, no.
And they had the farm that they operated.
They put them to work, yes. They worked the farm that was present. They had dairy, chickens, hogs, vegetables, fruit.
No longer.
Oh, no.
I imagine they have
Ronald Reagan did. Ronald Reagan did away with it.
Reagan was the one that stopped all the farm.
Why?
Well, there was a...
too much expense?
There was a difference in philosophy. They couldn't ask the boys to do anything. They were just incarcerated. And
treated him then, which meant let him go and discover bother anybody else.
Well, wow. You'd be much better off out there digging around, you know, and keeping your mind off your problems.
They were better off, too, the boys were.
I think they were.
Much better.
But they were getting in the group. Well, the whole concept changed. They were the hardcore. And they ran up to age 21 instead of being limited to 18 or 19. And they just got to a place where they really couldn't put them out on the farm.
Yeah.
Well, it was the hardcore one. Where they would escape. They got to chase them down. And then they got better transportation, automobiles, better roads. And pretty soon anybody that did escape was
long gone.
Yeah, in San Francisco, 2.5 hours. In Los Angeles, 6 hours. Or something like that.
There's one at Pine Grove, isn't there?
Yeah, but it's new by age.
But the rest of the state still owns the property up here. They rent it out. There's no more farm. I think they do have construction in some plant, like machine shop.
Yeah, I think so.
Woodworking.
Yeah, they had an article in the paper here about, I don't know, 6 months ago or so, showing their shops, that they're able to keep them all indoors there. They don't get them. Mainly probably auto shop and welding shop and stuff like that. Yes. You know, must have been rough on the roads in the old days. Did you go down to San Francisco much or any, or get out of the...
Went to Sacramento quite often.
Yeah.
But they finally would drive with a horse and, I don't know, just spring wagon or whatever they took. To shop about every 6 months.
To Sacramento?
To Sacramento.
Well, one day it took town, one day it took that.
Well, yeah, I guess to go to San Francisco, I don't know if they had, I think they had a train.
Yeah, sure. Well, you could go to Sacramento.
Well, you could go to Sacramento and take the ferry boat. Well, could you take the boat?
That's
or the train.
Well, yeah, sure, you could take the train. See, when you left Iowa, you go by train. And then there's the old Sacramento Northern
Railroad through the valley,
ran up to all the Sacramento. So you change trains at Harold and get to Sacramento.
Well,
I have been in a...
It sounds nostalgic, but I'm sure it was dirty.
I've been in a horse and like when we tried it. No, it's an early automobile I was in. And we got stuck down here between Sacramento and Ione. I had to sit there while my husband went out to find some help somewhere. And the coyotes howled all around. Yeah. Martin, weren't you there then?
Oh, yes, I remember that.
You did?
I was maybe 5 or 4.
Well, when you came out on the train, I guess, in St.
Yes,
Louis,
we came
right?
Yes, we came on the train.
Well, I still, you know, I can say to yourself, my, how nostalgic that it'd be neat. And I'm sure it was fun in a sense for a while, but then it probably got pretty tedious and monotonous.
No wonder the old people took to religion and drink.
Spiritualism or something.
Yeah, Mrs. Dusky turned out to be a great spiritual follower, and there were a number around
over
the county, yeah.
Into spiritualism?
Yeah.
Into religion?
Yeah, that's right.
Well, that was in, you know, in 1922, Conan Doyle came to the United States to lecture on spiritualism at Carnegie Hall. He broke all the world's records, and he followed with William James Bryan, who was speaking on God and evolution.
Yeah.
But when you talk about spiritualism, most people think of it today as ghosts and stuff. Well,
yeah.
It was, but it was a religion, as you saw.
Yes, it was.
And so many people lost loved ones and this and that, the war and everything, and they preached love in another, you know,
life.
Go to another, you know, another life and another world, and boy, it was, you know, a good time.
Yes, that was before Brian's time, though. That Marion, the Templeman relative out in Jackson Valley, there was some out there that took up with it.
There isn't, I guess, not much around
that. I doubt there is. There's some things just as funny and odd.
When poor old Doyle came over here, and all they wanted him to do was talk about Sherlock Holmes.
Yeah.
He couldn't do it. Giving it up. He died believing. But something would happen. Well, I tell you.
I just can't even believe pitching up a horse to a buggy and going into Wyoming back. Which,
and my father-in-law made that trip every day. Kept the mail every day.
Well, this country out here, so never kind of so good immigrants, really. When they came over to Boston Place in 1867, and by 1870, they were the mother. Was incapacitated. I don't know what it was. Heart fitted condition anyway. She never walked again. And she lived 28 years, she said. That's a crippled, well, you know, it's crippled. Bedridden. But good part of the time. She didn't die until 1828. Really, 1828. Some of the relatives of John Mayer, I think, told her 28 years. And some of the others were, well, I said 27. But it was a long time, you know. Strong constitution. And of course, two of her daughters gave their lives to take care of her.
Well,
he voted himself.
Yeah.
Yeah, he voted himself to it. I think one died in 1907.
Shortly after we were married.
1911. Yeah. Something like that. And then, of course, when part of the family had gone to San Francisco, and then from the Great White Jet,
they came up here. Exactly. They left nothing to have plenty at the table.
Michael sent some of his children up here. I was trying to think, he kept the older boy, William, and the older two boys, I don't know.
Charles.
And Wilkes stayed with him in San Francisco. And they tried to rebuild. What business were they in the city? You know, I don't know, but they owned property on Knob Hill, and they lost that. I guess traded around and got a parcel on Russian Hill, which the family still owns.
22 something 11, right?
2112, I think it was.
You don't know Kimmy Kelly, do you?
No, my family, they were from San Francisco, and they had some land, and they lost it. What happened was the fire didn't get to it, and the quake didn't, but they dynamited it to make a fire line, and I don't know if you were in there, you didn't get into the back. Just lost it all.
Well,
I don't know the history of what happened with the property. Well, they wanted to save all those mansions up there, and if you were below it or wherever it was, a little lower, boy, they blew you up, because they weren't going to blow Mark Hopkins' place up. I don't know what happened to it.
James Fair, the Fairmont Hotel,
yeah.
That
was the, yeah, that was.
The Mark was, well, the new Mark, it wasn't there then.
Yeah.
I guess it wasn't there.
You know, the Crocker Mansion, I
don't know what the property was. So on the Knob Hill area, but they owned it. It wasn't very big. It wasn't one of the biggest mansions.
But Uncle Mike, I had a paper route.
Well, that's, he was a distributor.
fine, but I guess we had a budget for Chinese work. They learned to speak Chinese, most of them do. And they knew everything. I think it was a problem.
I'm not sure about it.
I think it was. And that's the way we read it after the game.
Well, it was lucky that they had a place to come to.
Well, they sent the kids up here. And, I don't know, they arrived a few days after the earthquake. Put them on the train. And here's top right down here in the field of Bell Mountain.
Oh, wow. No kidding.
They walked up through the fields. And I guess my grandmother was a little bit upset. She wondered what was happening when she found out that they had to find a place for him to sleep. See, everything was pretty well crowded for their own family.
Well, the kids were raised in the city then, right?
Well, that group.
That group. Well, that must have been pretty strange on them, you know.
They even went to school up here.
Well, I think they arrived here on a little Friday or a Saturday. At any rate, she started sending them to school next Monday.
In New York for 8 days when we were again overcome by the love of the deep with all its peculiar pleasures and sensations. We hauled up anchor on Vanderbilt steamer called the Granada and sailed away for the shores of Nicaragua. We had all become fairly good sailors by this time except Jake and Dora. The sailors heaved up anchor, the remembrance of other days overcame both, and they heaved up everything that was at all heavable. All through Key West and the beautiful coast of Jamaica, it was all dead horse to both of them. At last we landed at San Juan and embarked on the river in small catboats. Sometimes we had to get off and walk while men pulled the boats over shallows and ripples. On the river we saw our first Indians, and some were stark naked, which scandalized our overly prudish passengers. The third day we changed for our boats on the lake and sailed the length of it. When we arrived on the other side, we had to travel 12 miles on a mule team, or if you preferred, you could do like Balaam, ride on an ass. We chose the former mule team, Jake and I, as the drivers, so as not to miss our boat. Now we embarked on the Grand Pacific. My recollections are more dim on this home stretch. I remember we celebrated the 4th of July. We also ran into the fog as we neared our destination and at last landed at San Francisco about July 8, 1867, at night. Next morning, we stood up at the Atlantic Hotel, somewhere on Jackson near Kearney. The following day, we took the boat to Sacramento. There was no connection by rail. We put up at Ebner's Hotel. They'd just been redoing that in Sacramento. Then a very pretentious building with a marble front. Josie and Lewis got their bearings and started for Antelope right away, while the rest of us lolled around on the porch in front of the hotel and mistook every driver of any vehicle that came our way as our long-lost brother John, whom Kate and I had never seen, left before they were born. At last, the man with a hay wagon hove in sight. Hitched to the wagon was a little gray mare and a tall brown horse. The gray mare was Fanny. It's B-E-R-N-E, Germanized by John, that you older boys surely all remember. And the man on the wagon was our brother John. His mother knew him right away, leaving mother alone for that. Kate, Jake, and I did not. Dora claims she recognized him too. But our brother John took us home, and we saw first your mother, Jake, Mary, and Lewis, all little father. I was somewhat surprised and disappointed in her. We had expected nothing but dark forests with wild Indians and all that belonged to bloody frontier. But the dried up country did not appeal to us. You know how dry antelope looks in July and August. But then the country was only in the making. No fruit trees. John was just experimenting and had planted some peach trees and was very much surprised that the trees did not die during the dry summer months. For the first time, he had planted tomatoes, and lo, rain or no rain, they bore fruit. I think he was the pioneer to do summer following and sow his grain before the rain and trust in Providence for the rest. And yet when he left Antelope, the experimental state had hardly begun. A few weeks after our arrival at Antelope, a sail crossed the horizon and Sister Mary with Herman cruised into port. That was Mr. and Mrs. Dutcher. I fell in love with Herman on first sight and never got thoroughly over it. When Mary and her husband returned to Ione, Lewis, Josie, and John Stryker went with them, and Ione Valley gripped them for good. When we left Germany, Mother had scraped together about $5,200. When we arrived here, Mother had about $3,100. She intended to buy a farm and have the boys work it. John wanted her to buy the Butler Ranch adjoining his place in the east along the railroad, 620 acres. It was held at $3,000. It had no improvements and looked its very worst this time of the year. When the folks struck Ione, they fell easy victims and bought the Potter Ranch. That's right here. It was improved with a house painted white and green shutters to its windows. What little things figure sometimes in shaping destiny. We paid $1,800 for 138 acres and moved on in September. Father strayed away one day when we were not watching him. He could not find him until the next day when a character called Crazy Jake came and told us he had seen a man of that description about 4 miles away. We went down that way and I spied him climbing a hill near Hazelville, and I think that's a mistake, it is another name. Father died about a month after we settled, after an affliction of about 26 years. We soon began to realize that Ione was not a heavenly place, but only preparatory. Owing to extensive mining, the creek had changed its course and overflowed at the slightest provocation, bringing chills and fever. One day, six of us were in bed, and only Mother was abroad. Jake had attached himself for good to his brother John, so escaped the preparatory as the rest of us were taking. The boys had to start at the bottom to learn California climbing, for they knew absolutely nothing, and in that respect had nothing on their little brother Mike. Kate and I started to school, and we certainly drew attention. We stood at the teacher's knee with the little toddlers and learned our ABCs. Kate outstripped me in the start, but she soon got 4 feet and quit. I was regarded as a boy brought down from the moon. The boys lifted up my feet to regard with wonder the hobnails and irons on my top boots, which were exactly like the trench shoes our boys brought home from over there. The teacher put me by the side of a young, irrepressible aunt of Satan, Frank Burris, who was thoroughly opposed to all education. as to himself, as well as everything associated with him.
You got any tags related to your mama?
I don't think
somebody
so.
Else?
Mm-hmm. I used to try to threaten him by saying, I'm not the teacher, father. He learned this phrase by heart. Frank called me to town later and never forgot to remind me of school days and the journey he learned. But in school, I soon left Frank. I left from ABC class to the third reader, and Frank never served that time. Later, I took up history, and the boys told about Washington, crossing the Delaware, with his safety cap and his blue bow, and captured 2,000 Germans. I tried to convince the boy that the Germans had simply double-crossed King George and made a bicker with Washington. But I had to demonstrate to them that if there was a yellow streak in this German boy, it was only skin deep and could very easily be rubbed off. Well, things went on very slowly on the farm. The latent success was certainly upgrade. About 2 years after the start, Lewis went to San Francisco. 8 days later, he wrote to prepare for the bride and arrived in due course of time. Andrew and Josie decided to let Lewis have the ranch alone, and they left, but I was part of the ranch and stayed off, and also mother. After a very few months, it became apparent that was saying that no house was big enough for a mother and daughter-in-law should be amended to include the farm. Of course, there are exceptions to this rule, and our family must never forget the remarkable exception at home with mother. While mother left the place, but I stayed on, mother settled with Lewis, and Josie and Andrew took up the farm again with Kate to keep house. Mother soon after took to bed and was helpless for 28 years. I wonder if we give Kate and Lewis full credit for their work. Well, the Almighty does. The boys left the Van Dusen place, where his daughter is down here, of 10 acres that had been sold off of the home ranch in 1862, and afterwards bought the Billy Wells ranch of 108 acres. They were beginning to have quite a nice place. The creek no longer overflowed, as mining had been stopped. The chills and fever had disappeared, but farming was never profitable until alfalfa came to the valley in 1871. Of course, dairying was still carried on in the old way by hand churn and so forth, but it left you a little pay for your labor. When I became 13, I worked on a threshing machine in the summer and for the boys in the winter. When 20, I worked on a fat aluminum hay press, and the next year I built one. I had intended to follow the family calling, mainly farming, for which I was suited, but the following year I started for town simply to get away from myself and forget. I went to school for a while. When Jake wrote me to go north with him to look for land, I went, but my heart was not in it. We started up one side of the valley to Arbuckle, Germantown, Willows, Red Bluff, Cottonwood, Cottonwood Creek. We found a place that suited us, 900 acres, 400 acres of sort of a creek bottom. The price was $9,000, but Jake could never say yes. We offered the man $8,000, thinking he would take it. We came down through to Hammond County and so forth to Ione. I drifted back into town and bought Lewis half of his grain business. The scheming of a partner, the deal was called off, the partner bought it. Then through the help of a half-interest swindler, I was roped into buying half-interest in a small livery stable. My partner was a Billy Fish Daisy, sure. And the experience in the next 5 years would keep a moving picture house in sensation for months. But Providence was kind to the poor darn man, and the man who had done up my two predecessors and did up my three successors earned me very little materially. As a makeshift, I bought a paper loop. And then I found a good girl who was willing to take a chance in a desperate game. Did she win or lose? I don't know. Ask her. As the game went on and the margin that we put up became greater, we were compelled to see the game through, and here we are, still in the game, after 31 years. I have been on the newspaper 33 years with 8 months up, when Johnny took me along to Alaska with him. I came back and took up the reins where I dropped them, and can surely say, God leads in a mysterious way.
Now, what's your connection with this matter with 1199?
Well, it was my husband's uncle.
Was his name Walter?
Yes. Yeah, Charles Winter's father.
Charles was one of the Methodist churches in Methodist Church for several years. You know, this is really great. We've got our tape pretty well used up, which is fine.
Well, maybe they won't care for
those. I think they will. I think they'll love it. Oh, that's the real thing. Now, that was written in 1930, and he was an elderly man then.
Mm-hmm.
So his memory went back to those things.
Charles was dead now, you know.
Yeah, just not too long ago, last year or so.
Mm-hmm.
Huh? Well, there's two other little things here. Now, when we came here, you had been a city girl, and you came here to the farm, and you were very surprised at the great amount of work that went on the farm, weren't you?
I didn't know anything.
You prepared much of your food from scratch, baked bread, preserved peaches, pears, plums, canned as many as 200 cans of tomatoes a season, using tin cans and sealing up with sealing wire.
That's right.
You butchered and cured your own meat, made sausage, and rendered lard. See if I've got anything else on here that I ought to think about. Well, this thing about that you saved the shucks from your corn crop.
Yeah, that was for tomorrow.
And the boys from Preston School, some of them came over.
That was during the war.
First World War. Some of the boys from the school came over and helped to prepare and bail these.
Yeah. Did you ever read Carrie McWilliams?
No.
Mrs. Angier uptown got a copy. I think she got an old copy for which they were charging something over $9 from the library. He was worked with WPA. You remember they hired artists and anything to get things started, and he was one of those. And he was on the air just the other night. I called her up and told her that Karen McWilliams was on, and she got to see him. And she's been reading this Factories in the Field, where he wrote about hiring men from the first, you know, to work. That was in the First World War.
That was Terry McWilliams? He was in this area?
We wrote about here in California.
Uh-huh.
And he's been editor of The Nation. Are you familiar with The Nation?
I'm not really familiar, but I know about it.
Yeah. Well, he's been editor of The Nation.
Uh-huh.
And he was on the air here the other evening.
Uh-huh.
And he tells about Prisoners
Living, Factories in the Field, was the name of his book.
But Mrs.
Angier
had. I read it years and years ago
since
it came out in the
30s. Do you remember when you prepared and bailed those corn husks? They were tamales, weren't they?
No, they were
poor tamales. Yeah, they were shipped from here to places where they make tamales, probably?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. They were in bales, and
they
went, I think they went by train.
Uh-huh. But you had no connection with the people that made tamales out of them.
I don't know what to.
Do you like tamales?
I can't eat them.
We love tamales.
Do you?
That was Mexican things. We think they've got a lot of good food.
Yeah. Oh, they do. I'm sorry, I left home.
Yeah, we left that. That's a good place sometimes. Takes tortillas and rolls them in the syrup and then we make tacos. Really smells so good, they pour them in the
way. Yeah, I like that.
It's not
it is good. It's from the mine. Clippings and stuff washed down onto the good land. They had an awful time ever getting rid of it. That's what the mining has done.
Well, they're still doing some of this clay mining around here to trace things up too, I think.
That's why I went to the board of supervisors and tried to gather something in their ordinance. I don't think they did it. And you know, the thing about that ordinance in the paper, except little tiny cramps in it. Now,
I
didn't
say anything about
when
it.
When it is so important.
Well, these days people are going to get hungry and they're going to think, you know, you can't spend all your time on and then not have any place to go and go through.
We had the company Sunday, two boys, I call them.
This interview is being made by Joe Groves, May 6, 1976. I want to start out here by saying who's talking and you know, a little bit about your experience. So, this interview is of Mrs. Nina Winter, who lives in Ione Valley, west of Ione. And her experience here dates back to 1911, I think you told me, didn't you? Now, I like this little thing that you told me. We'll go through this. It'll only take just a very few minutes, and we'll get into some of those details that you have there. But you told me that your husband Paul graduated from Greenville College in Illinois in 1910. And he returned to Greenville then in 1911 when you graduated and you were married and you came by train here to California. And I'm looking for kind of interesting little stories here for myself, but then we're going to be interested in all your more serious history there. The Southern Pacific engineer has stopped the train and let you and your husband get off the train as it passed the little farm. Let me see. Paul's parents plan to retire. I want to be sure that I get this right. Paul's parents plan to retire, and they soon turned the farm over to you and Paul. And the farm operation comprised a durian hog ranch and alfalfa and corn for the stock. I thought this was a kind of a cute little thing. You found it necessary to plant your vegetable garden in the middle of a cornfield because Native Indians harvested any food they found growing. These are the sort of things that I'm interested in, but then I know that we're going to be interested in all those things you had there. Commercial orchards grew in the Ione Valley, producing excellent peaches, cherries, plums, and nuts. The Wilson Orchard and Packing Shed operated on Ritter Road, the road that now leads from Highway 104 to Mrs. Winter's house. That was the Earl Food Company, was it?
Not at that time.
Not at that time.
Wilson.
Uh-huh.
George Wilson. They called it Uncle Joe. There were two brothers, and they came from the east. I'm not sure whether New York or New Jersey, but from the east, and they were merchants. And one of them passed away, and Uncle George, the brother, married his widow. And he was Uncle George Wilson, and he owned the two ranches. And they also raised berries. As well as the fruit. That was considered one of the finest parts think, early days. But that was before 1911.
No, it's recording.
In the 1870s, they were winning prizes with their food at fair. And the orchard did very well until the Depression days came. And that is when the early fruit company came in. And that was sometime maybe in the late 1920s.
The person was 29.
Well, later.
Uh-huh.
And the Earl Fruit Company had Japanese living property, and there was a great deal of complaint from the people in Ione about having Japanese, but I guess it was all he could do. They were shipping their fruit to New York, and it wouldn't sell, and so they would be having to pay the freight besides the loss of fruit. So they just couldn't go on that way.
You know, it kind of amazes me that we've come up here and started our little place out there, and we've worked hard to put in a garden and all that. It isn't easy out where we are. I know it's entirely different than it is here.
Mm-hmm.
So our experience with Amador County and seeing much of it is that it isn't really an awfully productive farm county on the whole. But then we get out here, and this is a very, very productive area.
Yes, indeed it is. Have you read Mason's description of it?
No, I haven't. I should.
Yeah. One of the most beautiful valleys that can be imagined before the mining interests. It's just amazing what could be grown here. And the climate was good. We had oranges, but they were not too successful as frost to take them. In fact, that was what killed our little tree. But they had winter gardens that they raised all kinds of winter vegetables as well as the summer gardens that they raised melons and everything like that. That was the one thing that the early settlers did when they first established a home was plant an orchard and a garden. I guess it wasn't easy to tear the land so that it was full of big trees and willows.
That was here in Ione Valley?
Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And they needed those things to live. For a time, there were hop fields. They even had hop dryers here in the valley. And alfalfa came in 1871, and that changed the whole complexion of the farming situation, as you might know.
Well, I'm interested in any of it, really, but they got all these people, there were a lot of people, there was a number of good-sized towns up there, most of the people were working in the global,
mm-hmm.
and of course they were hungry,
mm-hmm.
and here was this beautiful, fertile valley, and so it was just natural then that someone would begin to meet the demand and supply the things, then.
Right.
And it must have... Ione Valley must have played an important part in that.
It did. I think my father-in-law used to peddle his fruits and vegetables and go to Milltown.
Milltown?
Mm-hmm. You know where that is.
Do you have anything to do with Mill Creek?
Yes. Mill Creek. Nothing left there now.
Was it towards Paul Joyce's place?
Maybe. Do you know where Quincy was?
Vaguely.
No, it's up in that direction.
Rural town.
Mm-hmm. Are you acquainted with Mrs. Coote from our church? Well, I think her father and mother may be from there.
From Rural town. And you three classes are in 104 between here and Iowa, doesn't it?
And it is right up the
street. Upstream. Mm-hmm. Upstream from Highway 104.
And there were apparently two parts of it. One was occupied by the Anglo-Saxons and the other by the Chinese. And when I came here, the Chinese still had people buried up in that direction. And they have finally moved all the bodies out because they have a superstition that they should be in their own country. But that was the way it was in my kingdom.
Now, Quincy, was that up here somewhere near the fire where the fire academy is now?
No, it was further away than that.
Back off the road there.
That's right. Back off the road, it's fenced in now as part of the grant, and I think I could get permission or something to go in there. They could probably show you. I've been there.
Do you know how far Rural Town was off of Highway 104? That was off north of Highway 104 too, upstream.
It might have been a couple of miles, maybe more, I guess.
But Quincy was further.
Yeah, probably further to the west. But that is another story, you see, that's part of the story of how it was built up, because it was supposed to be part of the grant, and those people were supposed to be just squatters, and apparently the army drove them out. They almost lived overnight, as nearly as I can figure out.
Well, anything that you have there, I'm interested in anything that you have there, really. And I know you've got a lot of it.
Well, I've not written out. Now, this you won't want, I don't think. Iron Valley is located in Amador County, California, in the foothills of the Sierras. It consists of several hundred acres of very productive land. Three creeks flow into the valley. Sutter Creek, Eagle Creek, and Dry Creek. The valley is surrounded by hills which contain certain minerals, clay, and lignite. In the early days, it was much admired for the large oak and cottonwood trees which grew along the banks of the streams. There was also an abundance of wild grapes and tall native grasses. It seemed to our ancestors to be an ideal place in which to establish a home. In order to understand some of the problems of the early settlers, a few historical facts should be considered. 200 years ago, when our forefathers were fighting for our independence, California and Mexico belonged to Spain. In 1822, Mexico won her independence from Spain, and for about a quarter of a century, California was governed by Mexico. In 1840, Juan J.U.E.N. Alvarado, governor of California, granted to Theodosia Yorba, it's spelled both ways, 11 leagues of land. The boundaries of this grant, known as Arroyo Seco, were very indefinite. It extended from the Cosumnes River on the north to the McCollumney River on the south, and from a Sacramento road on the west to the Sierra Nevada mountains on the east. All of Ion Valley was included in this grant. By 1846, the United States seemed to be of a mind to expand. President Polk declared war on Mexico, in which the United States was victorious. By the Treaty of Hidalgo Guadalupe, in May 1848, we gained California as well as other territory, and by 1850, California became a part of the Union. In 1852, Yorba sold the Arroyo Seco grant to Andres Pico for 500 head of cattle. The deed was recorded in Los Angeles County and later in Amador County. The United States government chose to consider that Andres Pico was the legitimate owner of the lands in this grant. Some parcels of land were sold, but some of them fell into the hands of unscrupulous land speculators. There was much litigation, and some of the early settlers were obliged to pay twice for their land. Do you remember the young man that we had at the Historical Society telling how they lost everything trying to get this thing settled? Some of the early settlers were obliged to pay twice for their land. There were many Indians living in the valley, but any right they had to the land seems to have been completely disregarded. The history of the Arroyo Seco grant is a sordid tale, and a long and complicated one. There was a Downey, I don't know his first name, who was governor of California in 1860, called this grant a rank fraud. The grant most certainly did affect the conditions of the newcomers to the valley. The owners of the Arroyo Seco grant always were absentee landlords, and they had little interest in the well-being of the county. In 1876, the smaller landowners complained that they paid more than their share of taxes, while the large landowners paid only a nominal sum. There are, at present, in 1975, acres of land in the Arroyo Seco grant in Amador County, and I haven't the amount of acres because it changes very rapidly. Sometimes it's this and sometimes it's something else. The landlords to this day have never lived on the grant, but tax assessments are still slanted in their favor. And you don't dare put that in.
I think it should be in. That's good.
In 1848, gold was discovered in California, and this led to a great influx of population. People came from Europe, South America, and the eastern part of the United States, and even China. For the most part, those who settled in Ion Valley were farmers and not miners. One of the first ranches to be settled was the Hicks Ranch. Now owned by Guard Chisholm of Sutter Creek.
He's running for Superior Court Judge, isn't he? One of them running for Superior Court Judge. About 60 little letters, I think.
I think so.
Anyway, he's your neighbor?
Yeah. It seems to have been established in 1847. That was even before then. Yes. And the owner was obliged to pay twice for the property because of the Arroyo Seco grant. A house was finally built there, part of which is said to have come around the horn. It later burned. I don't know the date when it burned. The Clarence Fairbanks family lived there for a number of years. Another early ranch was the Kew Ranch, which received its name from Henry Gibbons, who was a member of Company Q of the Ohio Volunteers. Date of sale, 1850. It was bought in 1853 by Charles Green. It became well known, and it had a post office, a blacksmith shop, and a racetrack. Dodge Ranch was another ranch that was well known in the valley, and Mr. Dodge came from Germany, from Europe, and he did his life. He lived up here on the hill, Carlton Winter owns it now, and he had a store across the road, and I think a bar, at least he sold liquor. And it was built in stone, and the house, I'm told, that they had was 3 years in building, and a part of it came around the horn. And Mr. Dodge was attacked one day, apparently out on the highway here, and by robbers, and so badly injured that he was in a wheelchair thereafter, and the family finally moved to Sacramento, and the two Winter brothers bought the property, the farm.
Yes, yes.
The Bosch.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know just what time his wife died, I think before he did. And I don't know what year, maybe 1890 sometime. But he was here for a long time. Where he had his warehouse and store, we used to have parties. It was quite a place. And now I have a old letter here that Uncle Mike wrote. He came here when he was 9 years old, and the family settled here. And it isn't very long, but it is fascinating, if you want me to get it. He lived in San Francisco. Realizing that I'm the only one left that could get a fairly
good... We'd better get a little bit of explanation on this, too, so that it'll be understandable on the tape. Now, this was written by whom?
By Michael Winter, who lived in San Francisco. And sometimes it says in the 1930s, I don't know just what date it was, written in the 30s for the reunion at the school.
Mm-hmm. This was written to you?
No, it was written to the whole family.
For the community, for the reunion. Well, that's great.
Realizing that I'm the only one left that could give a fairly good account of our exit from Germany and our entrance into America, I will try to give as accurate a narrative as I can after the lapse of 52 years. In order to make it plain, I must go back to the year 1866, which is as far as my recollections are vivid. It was the year of the war between Prussia and Austria. We South Germans were then under Austrian sovereignty. Consequently, fought on that side greatly against our wills and better judgment. Josie and Lewis had been drafted and had departed for the front, and Andrew, a reservist, was to school the following week. Our mother got the Burgomeister to intercede for her with the Secretary of War on the grounds that our father was an invalid who needed someone to watch him at all times, and the remaining four children were minors. We, however, got no action on this intercession, and the day of Andrew's departure came. When he left the house to report, Mother fell on her knees and consigned her three boys to the Almighty's care. The war was supposed to become a great religious war with the same opponents practically that had fought the 30-year war. But fortunately, when the foes met in battle, the Prussians were armed with breech-leading needle guns, and the Austrians still clung to the antiquated muzzle-loading affairs, so the war turned out a howling farce with one great battle and some minor affairs, the Prussians shooting several times while the Austrians shot once. Along about October, the boys were all at home. About 2 months after they left, one day at dinner, Josie said he was going to America, that he was tired of going out to fight for no one knew what. And this was in Württemberg, Germany, not far from Stuttgart. Josie said there would surely be war with France in the near future. Napoleon III was on the throne of France at this time and had been the whole thing in Europe. And now that Prussia had absorbed all of Germany, there must be a showdown very quickly. Louis agreed with Josie and said he was going also. John had gone to America 14 years previously, and Mary, Husky, about 4 years after John. Well, said Mother, if you go and leave me only the smaller children and a sick husband, we'd better all go. And by 3 o'clock, we had made up our minds to go. I, as the youngest of the family, was asked, and wisely I decided to follow my bread and butter, no matter where it led. Jake was the only one, and Dora, who did not take kindly to the idea. Jake was a blacksmith's helper and liked his job, and Dora was just beginning to see the boys as well as the girls around about. But they were both minors. Father was not asked. Mentally, he was, so it did not matter where he was. In the course of time, the small parcels of land were sold, and household goods auctioned off, and on the 14th day of May, 1867, the town bid us goodbye and Godspeed. A great number walked with us to the station, for in Europe, nearly all the people in a small town are somewhat related. I considered myself by far the most important person in the kingdom on that day. With Josie, it was not such a simple matter. He was still enrolled in the army, home on prolonged leave. But in those days, Germany was well supplied with secret agents, either in the employ of steamship companies or our government here. These agents would, for a very small consideration, smuggle any political refugee over the Swiss or French border. Sounds like today. Once over, you were secure. Josie started a month ahead of the family in care of an agent by the name of Decker. Josie, by trade, was a wheelwright. When they got to the Rhine, the agent had him write back home to say that he was working for a man by the name of Sauer at Koblenz. When the authorities inquired for him, Mother showed the letter, and that sufficed. The man was a friend, and he understood. So we started on our trip. 8 of our own family and John Stryker. We went by Stuttgart, Frankfurt, through Hessen, and at last arrived at Hamburg, where we stopped 3 days waiting for a ship. At last we embarked on an old tub named the Prussia, with 900 other wonderlust possessed people.
I think it's fine now.
When we at last got out on the deep, our troubles began. I think there is something in the doctrine of mind and matter. Jake and Dora had a mind to be deadly sick, so they could blame their mother for carrying them away from their dear old happy home. Their mother was really worried and feared that the mal de mer, this is supposed to be French, would prove fatal, but after 14 days, and people have doubted that, we arrived all alive at Hoboken, and the next day Josie met us at Castle Garden. We now look for Josie as an old experienced American who was supposed to be a thorough English linguist. An old crony of Josie, who came over with Josie, also over the underground route, taught me my first English that night. It was to say, good evening. It took a course in school to make me forget my first lesson. Josie showed us the town of New York thoroughly. I saw a wild beast for the first time in Central Park Menagerie.